It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard around the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host, Mark Young. I almost messed my own name up.
Well, it's because you're Chuck the Oppressor from now on.
Chuck the Oppressor, that's right. That's who I am. Well, we have another, a little bit of the Constitution today, which I'm really excited about.
We are back to our series, Chuck, with our friend Adam Winkler, who is a professor of school at the UCLA School of Law and author of the book, We the Corporation. And Adam, I want to congratulate you on your award for your book that you just got.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun to get a little recognition for my book. But I had a better award for my first book, the book I wrote about the Second Amendment called Gunfight, that came in this past week. Even though that book is like 7 or 8 years old, just on Friday night, it was a subject of a clue on Jeopardy. And the question was answered by this already legendary Jeopardy champion, James Holhouser, who's
this guy's amazing, isn't he?
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
And he knew your book?
Well, yeah, it was the source of a question. The question was, in the book Gunfight is about the interpretation and history of this amendment to the Constitution. So he guessed, what is the Second Amendment? And that was, right answer. And it was fun. I was getting notices from all my friends all over the country. When you're on Jeopardy, people notice.
Yeah. So I got to tell you a little game show quiz or game show trivia, as we happen to have a legendary game show host on the show here. Chuck, you were actually, first off, you are a question in categories, I think it is. But anyways, you were a question on your own show and somebody got it wrong.
That's right. I was. I did a show called Greed on Fox Nighttime. And I can't remember what the question was, but I was the answer. And the guy said, I've been watching you all my life, blah, 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 and he gave the wrong answer.
The question was, who was the original host of Wheel of Fortune?
Yeah, right. Yeah, he missed it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well. You were the right answer.
That sounds like a good reason to take a break for 2 minutes and 2 seconds.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Adam, for that. I appreciate it.
Well, Adam, we're going to go through articles. We've already been through, you know, all of the original Constitution, and we've been starting through the articles. So today we are going through Amendment 4 through 8. I'm going to start off just reading number 4 to people get it started. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, comma, but upon probable cause, comma, supported by oath or affirmation, comma, and particularly describing the place to be searched, comma, and persons or things to be seized. They loved commas.
Comma.
And long sentences, too. That's a really long sentence. It could use a few periods, don't you think?
Yes.
It is a bit of a run-on sentence. So, Professor, lead us off here. What is Article 4 or Amendment 4 about?
Well, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution is definitely one of the most important provisions of the Constitution. It is invoked in court more than any other constitutional right. It's at issue anytime the police arrest someone, anytime the police want to execute a search warrant and search someone's property. It's even at issue every time a car gets pulled over by a police officer for a traffic violation. So the Fourth Amendment is really of utmost importance, and it's part of a series of amendments of the Constitution, the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth that we're going to talk about today that are known as the criminal procedure amendments to the Constitution. You know, we often think of the Bill of Rights as being about, freedom of conscience and freedom of speech and religious freedom, those kind of fundamental rights. But so much of the Bill of Rights is really about the investigation, prosecution, and punishment of criminal defendants. And the Fourth Amendment and the amendments that we're going to talk about today all relate to that issue. And this important Fourth Amendment provides a set of privacy rights when the government's trying to investigate you.
So right now, I'm going to drift into what's going on in D.C. right now. The Congress has now issued subpoenas to the banks of the president, trying to get bank records of his prior to even being the president. And the president is putting up a fight. Is he fighting that based on the Fourth Amendment?
I think he's probably going to try to rely on the Fourth Amendment. He's also been relying on sort of inherent questions of executive power and executive privilege in fighting these subpoenas, arguing that the president doesn't have to give up the information that he gets from his closest advisors. But if he's trying to protect these bank records, then he really is going to be using the Fourth Amendment, protecting against unreasonable searches and seizures, unless there's a warrant issued for probable cause.
You know, I don't think most people realize it, but I really didn't until recently, that during the Mueller investigation, President Trump apparently is the only president that did not exercise his executive privilege.
Well, I maybe that's the case. I haven't seen anything about that. I mean, one thing we do know, though, is that the president declined to give live testimony.
That's different. That's not executive. But that was a whole different area, I understand. But he gave up everybody, all of his people. He allowed them to go in and talk to the special prosecutor. He allowed all the materials. He never once said, I'm going to claim executive privilege here and you can't have this stuff.
Yeah, you're correct about that, Chuck. He actually did not limit any amount of documentation that they asked for.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is unusual, I think. But anyway, we're not talking about that. We're talking about something else. So let's go on with what you're doing.
So, Professor, when I was a cop long, long time ago, we were trained, and I don't know if this has changed, we were trained that if we stopped a car and we pulled someone over, if they were seated behind the steering wheel, we didn't have the right to demand that they open the trunk of that car.
That's right.
And the reason being because we could only search what was in the immediate reach of this person because of our personal safety.
That's right. So the Fourth Amendment, first of all, provides basically, it says you can't conduct searches and seizures without a warrant as a general matter, right? You generally need a warrant. You need to go to a court and a neutral arbiter and provide evidence under oath to support the idea that you should have a warrant to go search someone's property. And so that's the general rule. And there are a series of exceptions to this rule that allow certain kinds of searches even without a warrant. And one of those exceptions is when a police officer has to protect his own safety. And if you are pulling someone over in a car and they have a gun in the passenger compartment of the car, then that officer could be at great, great risk to himself. And so the courts have devised a rule that doesn't necessarily fit comfortably with the text of the Fourth Amendment, but that says it's not an unreasonable search for the police to look in the passenger compartment of a car when it pulls it over for a traffic stop. But you're right, you can't go in the trunk because something in the trunk is not an immediate danger to the police officer.
So the way we would get around that, and I'm telling people this because you need to know your rights, we might say to the person, would you open your trunk for me? So we weren't demanding they open the trunk. We would say, would you mind opening your trunk? And if the person complied, then I didn't forcibly open their trunk. But if I did see, let's say there was a body in that trunk, because they voluntarily opened it, then I could proceed under another rule, which I believe is called plain sight.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what you're getting at really points at something that people don't realize, which is how much privacy the Fourth Amendment provides them against searches. I think most people think that if a police officer pulls you over and asks to look in your trunk, that you have to say yes, that you have to consent to that search. But you really don't. You don't have to consent to it. And the Fourth Amendment gives you that right not to consent to that search. Same thing when a police officer comes knocking on your door at home. I think many people are intimidated in that situation and believe they have to open the door for the police officer if the police officer requests it. But that's not the case. A police officer can search your home against your will, but must have a warrant to do so. Going and asking for someone's consent, even if they give that consent in a sort of an intimidating situation where they feel like they might not have a lot of choice, has led the courts to say, well, it's not a search against your will. You've allowed it to happen.
So what about the case of someone is walking down the street, they're minding their business, and the police pull up, you know, roll up next to them and ask them if they have any ID? What does the Constitution tell us about that?
Well, the Constitution says that you as the pedestrian can go on your way and can keep walking, that the police do not have a right to stop you unless they have some reason to believe that you may have evidence of a crime or that you may have committed a crime. They need some evidence to really stop you. Just to stop you and even to ask your ID is to invade your privacy somewhat. Now, of course, the courts are going to be sort of reluctant to second-guess police officers when they're checking IDs as part of broad investigations into, say, if you know, you get your ID checked when you go onto an airplane. You know, you have to even go through a search when you do that. And the courts have said that that kind of situation is one in which you don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And without a reasonable expectation of privacy, the Fourth Amendment does not apply.
How about people, let's say I'm crossing the border from Canada to the U.S. and Customs and Immigration decides they want me to open my trunk and look and tear everything up out in my car. That's not protected?
Right. Here's the interesting thing. It's not protected. And at the border, the Supreme Court has held that the border control can search your bags, even without any evidence or probable cause to believe you've committed a crime. So at the borders, there's much greater power in the police or in immigration control to search your bags than there would be once you're inside of the country.
So how is it that at least here in Michigan, a DNR officer, so a Department of Natural Resources officer, has the right to forcibly open your trunk. And he can do that under the auspices of poaching.
Well, I'm not familiar with that rule or with any cases that have interpreted it, but as a general matter, I mean, you'd need to have some probable cause under the Fourth Amendment to look into someone's trunk as a general matter. But maybe this is a rule that applies only in special places where there's a lot of hunting going on. I can't really speak to that particular example, not being familiar with it. But it would be unusual to allow enforcement control over something like poaching to get into your trunk. Because after all, we don't allow people to just go into your trunk if we're enforcing laws against murder or drug dealing, which might be much more significant than laws against poaching.
The rule would be if the DNR officer was given information that someone was seen poaching, driving a brown Chrysler, and now you have a brown Chrysler. So those are the breadcrumbs that they would follow to do that.
Right. And that seems like a pretty thin reed. You know, there is an exception, as we mentioned, for exigent circumstances when generally exigent circumstances, the way we talked about them earlier, is where the police officer faces a threat. But there are times where the courts say that where evidence can be destroyed imminently, then we'll allow police officers more leeway to try to search to recover that evidence. Maybe when it comes to poached animals, maybe that's the exception that they're thinking of.
Well, you know, it's funny because we all watch live PD, things like that. They're pulling people over all the time. Sometimes it's traffic stop. Most generally it is, or if they've crossed the center line or whatever. And when they do that, you watch this, you know, by cameras that they're wearing, saying, you know, you need to get out of the vehicle. I want to take a look at your license. I want to see what's inside the vehicle. I'd like to do a search of your vehicle. And they go ahead and do it anyway. And I've seen people say, no, you can't do that. No, you can't see my ID. No, you can't, you know, I'm just not going to comply at all. And it looks like they're guilty, but in fact, they may be just exercising their rights.
They may be. And I think that's an issue for many people when they're asserting their Fourth Amendment rights, when they're saying no to a police officer who wants to search something that the police officer is not entitled to search, is that they feel, I'm suggesting that I'm guilty by not allowing a search. We need to recognize that just because you don't want to be searched doesn't mean you're guilty of a crime. I don't believe, and the Fourth Amendment reflects the attitude that that you, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear.
Well, it's kind of like the Fifth Amendment too. If you take the Fifth Amendment, everybody just immediately assumes, okay, he's guilty.
That's right. If he claims the right to remain silent, the right against self-incrimination, people will think someone's guilty just from asserting it. But what the Constitution means is that you have that right. So you shouldn't ever be embarrassed to assert your constitutional rights.
So do you think that, and this is a tricky question, because I'm a supporter of law enforcement. Chuck is a supporter of law enforcement. But do you think that the Fourth Amendment is something that law enforcement frequently violates, and that we as a population probably need to be more vigilant in safeguarding?
Well, I think probably so. I think there's many instances where police officers take advantage of the Fourth Amendment and take advantage of the intimidation factor that is presented by someone in an officer's uniform coming to your door or pulling your car over, and the authority that they have can intimidate people from exercising their rights, and we really need to teach people their rights. We do know that the Fourth Amendment is violated often by police officers, but the courts have developed a rule that limits the harms that are caused by police officers violating the Fourth Amendment. And it's kind of controversial, but it's known as the exclusionary rule. And it's a rule that says that any evidence that's obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment through an unlawful search will be excluded from criminal proceedings. The police can't use that evidence if they gained it through an improper search. And that's exclusionary rule is not something that's built into the text of the Constitution. And some people have argued that we shouldn't be excluding valid evidence from a trial, no matter how it's recovered. But the courts do justify the exclusionary rule as basically creating the right incentives. If police know they can't use the evidence against the criminal, then maybe they're going to be a little bit more careful in obtaining the evidence properly.
So if you ever watch a TV show like NCIS or Hawaii Five-O, do you just go out of your mind watching the nonstop constitutional violations that are taking place over the course of 60 minutes?
Indeed, but you don't even have to watch the television to see these kinds of stories. I mean, in New York, they had a big process where they were practice of what they call stop and frisk, where they were just stopping people on the street and frisking them to see if they had guns on them. And part of the idea is police officers can often pat someone down if they're fearful that the person has a gun on them, because the gun presents a very present risk to the police officer trying to enforce the law. And so New York went out there and was stopping and frisking. Of course, you know who gets stopped and frisked. It's not the rich white guys. It's mostly disproportionately poor and the racial minorities who were continually stopped and frisked. And many people felt that it was a broad violation of their civil liberties to just be stopped like this, even if there's no particular reason to think that person is guilty of a crime.
So let me ask you something, see what you think of this. In the state of Maryland, Maryland has very restrictive gun rights and gun laws. So Maryland is actually now taking photographs of license plates as they cross into the state, you know, over the state boundary. And they are running license plates of out-of-state vehicles. And if the driver of that out-of-state vehicle holds a concealed weapons permit in another state, they're pulling that car over to see if that driver is going through their state armed. Does that hold up?
That seems highly questionable based on those facts. Just the mere fact that someone has a concealed carry permit is not reason to believe that person is carrying that gun in a car, and it is not reason to believe they're taking that gun across state lines, especially if crossing state lines would be illegal to do so. It doesn't seem like that would be good probable cause to go search someone's vehicle.
I've been shocked that they've been able to get away with it. I've been hearing some of the same thing has been happening more on an anecdotal level, hearing some of these same kind of things happening with vehicles coming out of Colorado in adjoining states.
Well, it really shows the lengths to which some lawmakers will go to try to crack down on people with guns. I mean, that's pretty hostile. People are allowed to have guns. And what we do need is laws making it clear that if you have a concealed carry permit and it's lawfully to carry your gun, that you can drive across state lines with that firearm in your car. You shouldn't necessarily be able to take out that gun and go carry it around another state if that state doesn't want people carrying guns. You know, that's a big constitutional question the court has yet to answer. But under the current law, at least, states are allowed to limit concealed carry. We shouldn't necessarily, though, impose burdens on people from other states when they're traveling just across state lines.
You know, it's very funny because I grew up in eastern Kentucky, Appalachia to be exact. And I don't know of a pickup truck that didn't have a gun rack in it with guns in it. Always, no matter where they went, everybody had a gun rack with two or three guns.
Yeah, rifles on the back window.
Yeah, yeah. And nobody.
Just don't drive into New Jersey, whatever you do.
Yeah, right. But yeah, Maryland. Anything about it.
So I want to drift off just for a second as we're talking about Maryland here. Right now, your driver's license is valid in all 50 states. So the states recognize a reciprocity of driving privileges. Would that be the right term for that?
Yes.
Why would there not be a reciprocity in a gun permit, the same as a driving license?
Well, you do have reciprocity for gun permits. It's just the way it works is that with regards to the driver's license, there's a compact, basically an agreement among all 50 states to recognize each other's driver's license. And there have been efforts to create a 50-state compact on concealed carry permits, but it's never really taken hold because there are about 10 states that don't allow concealed carry and don't want people carrying guns in their states. And so, but I should say those compacts do exist at a state-to-state level.
Yeah, and there's 36 of them, right?
Yeah, about 36 states. In most of the country, they do have these compacts, and your concealed carry license will be recognized in another state. But it's more limited than driver's license, and it's just because the driver's license situation is not a federal law that requires it. It's actually just a voluntary agreement among the 50 different states, and you just don't have that kind of consensus on gun carry permits.
Okay, so it's not a federal issue. So what else do we need to know about the Fourth Amendment before we move on?
Well, there's certainly plenty to talk about with the Fourth Amendment. One
How
of the biggest
the
areas
Amendment
these
come
days.
About? What's the origin of the Fourth Amendment? Why
well, the
did
origin
the founders come up with this?
Right. Well, one of the big things the founders were concerned of was something called writs of assistance. Back in the colonial days, the crown would issue writs of assistance that would allow people's homes to be searched to make sure they didn't have goods that were taxed and didn't pay the tax. So there was a whole bunch of the way government raised revenue in the colonial period is by taxing different kinds of goods, imports, exports, or putting, say, a tax on stamps or a stamp on paper. And then to enforce those laws, they would use these general writs of assistance that would just allow constables, essentially, to go in and tax collectors to go into any home and search the home to see if they had any goods that were taxable but hadn't been paid. And this was a big controversy. The framers hated this. And the idea of the Fourth Amendment was to say, hey, if you want to search someone's home, you need individualized suspicion that that person's done something wrong. You need probable cause to believe that that's someone or someplace that needs to be searched. And we're not going to allow you to just do it willy-nilly. You got to go before a judge and get a judge to say, hey, okay, I'm going to give you a warrant and allow you to do that search. So these are very important protections.
And that carries over to any kind of vehicle, whether it's an airplane, a car, your tractor, right? Any that matter
your home.
Well, your home naturally, but I'm just saying,
would this also carry over to wiretapping your communications?
It would. This was a big issue back maybe a half century ago. The Supreme Court originally said the Fourth Amendment did not apply to wiretapping because wiretapping doesn't fit comfortably within the text of the 14th Amendment that refers to secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. But in the 1950s and 60s, the Supreme Court changed its view on wiretapping and said that the Fourth Amendment's not just designed to protect places, but also personal privacy. And wiretapping someone's communications is a kind of violation of personal privacy.
All right. What else do we want to cover on the Fourth?
Well, the thing to look for with the Fourth Amendment is really how it's going to apply in the era of digital technology and computers. You know, we give up so much information every day to Facebook and to Google and to Apple or Android. We're giving them all this information. And the question is often arising is, can the government now access that information? There's an old rule of the Fourth Amendment that says, this is about protecting privacy. If you reveal the information voluntarily to a third party, then it's not private information and the government can get it even without a warrant. Well, what does this mean when we're giving up all this information, sometimes not really thinking about it, to Google or to Apple or to Facebook, and then the government wants to get that information from those companies and issues a subpoena saying, give us that information? It really invades our privacy in some way, but under the old doctrine, it's not covered.
Give me an example of some of those things, of pieces of information we would voluntarily give up to the third party.
Well, what you do is when you go on Google and you search for things, and you know, your Google searches will include everything about your tastes, may it include where you're traveling to, who your friends are, who you're networking with and having business meetings with, may even reveal your, I don't know, your hidden or sensitive sexual preferences or things that are embarrassing to you. And you give that information up, not because you're giving it up, but because you're just doing a Google search. But Google collects that information, and there's real questions about whether prosecutors can just go get that information now without a warrant even, because, hey, you've given it up to third parties. It's not private anymore. Our notions of privacy are really fundamentally changing, and the old Fourth Amendment rules are really going to struggle in the age of a digital economy.
So I've really been concerned about this one. And I'll give you an example, Chuck. I'm going to give you a couple. One was we were doing a show, and it was a show where people were talking, that we were talking to some time back, and we were discussing people being able to go online and get the plans to be able to make a bomb.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I went to Google, and I was Googling how to make a bomb because I wanted to see if it came up.
Right.
So could my Google search results be used against me that I'm a bomb maker?
Well, obviously, to prove that you're a bomb maker, they'd need more than you just did a Google search as enough evidence. But the question is, could the government get that evidence from Google that you looked up the information for this search? And the answer would be yes. You've given up that information to a third party. A third party has it. And under the current rules, the government can access that information. I think part of the thing we really need to think is about, don't we have an expectation of privacy in things like our Google searches, even if we know maybe deep down inside that these companies will be aggregating that data and using it in some way, shape, or form. You can't even sneeze these days without Google responding with an ad for Kleenex.
Mm-hmm. What about, I've seen cases where some idiots, criminals will go out and videotape, let's say they videotape themselves beating somebody up and then post it on their Facebook page. And the police have used that as evidence against them.
And, you know, all you can kind of think of is this is Darwin at work. Like, who beats up someone
Absolutely.
And then posts it on Facebook?
Right. But once they post that video on Facebook, that ceases to become, that's public
information.
It's not
private anymore.
At that point, right?
That's right. It becomes public information. You've now revealed it to the world. And if you've revealed it to the world, you can't complain that the government's going to use it.
Now, how does this, on the fourth, how would the fourth play in to warrants such as FISA warrants?
Right. So this is a really interesting, the FISA warrants, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act courts, are courts that among the things that they do is provide warrants for investigation of foreign intelligence. And so this became a big issue under the presidency of George W. Bush after 9/11, where he had a wiretapping program where any phone call between an American and someone abroad would be effectively searched. It would the call would then, the information from the call would be put into these databases, large databases, not sort of individually checked one by one, but put in these large databases for various kinds of research purposes and investigatory purposes. And there were some questions about whether this violated Fourth Amendment rights, because there wasn't probable cause to believe that every single person who was phoning someone abroad was engaged in terrorism or any illegal activity. In fact, we presume the opposite. But one question that's come around is, are the profound interest in national security and in fighting terrorism, does that make a search a little bit less unreasonable in the context because the government's reasons are so important and national security is so important? So that's been a real pressing issue in the national security context.
So I'm not saying this happened, but there seems to be some evidence to it. So if people in the FBI used bad evidence, such as the Steele dossier, and presented that to a FISA judge to get a FISA warrant to go in and essentially eavesdrop on Carter Page, who worked for the president, are the people who did that, do they have a potential risk from legal, you know, some kind of crime?
It's possible that in those circumstances there could be a legal risk. One thing the Fourth Amendment makes clear is that to get a warrant, that it must be sworn, that it made, that the must be the evidence must come from an officer taking an oath or affirmation. The idea is that you're saying that you believe this evidence to be correct and accurate evidence. And if the evidence was fraudulent and the person who was introducing the evidence knew it was fraudulent, then that person could be in significant problems and have significant liability. If, however, and this does happen, prosecutors genuinely believe or sincerely believe some evidence is accurate, and it then later turns out the evidence is inaccurate, we generally don't say that prosecutors are going to be responsible for that, as long as they had a good faith belief in the accuracy of the information.
So in this particular case, it would appear, and Chuck, you followed this pretty well, it would appear that most everyone knew that the Steele dossier was just innuendo. But it was somewhat the crux of those warrants, is what we understand, that it was the basis of it. So that could be interesting.
That could be interesting to see how that plays out in the future as we get more evidence as to what exactly was on the prosecutor's
mind. Well, the interesting thing is the background of this thing. It was around. It was all over Washington for a long time. And no one legitimately would touch it because it couldn't be verified, none of it. And then when Brennan and I guess Clapper introduced it to Trump, then BuzzFeed picked it up and said, well, that's news. So all of a sudden it became a news item. And then it was out there, even though it had not been verified by anyone. And then it was used.
That was actually a case of that really, if you follow what happened there, that was almost a case of evidence laundering in that particular case. So let's move on to Article 5, Amendment 5. This is the one that everybody's always used to hearing. I think people probably think it's much broader than it is. But the Fifth Amendment.
Right. We always say, you always hear people say, I'm going to plead the Fifth. Well, they're referring to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. They're going to take advantage of the protections for their individual rights provided for in the Fifth Amendment. And the Fifth Amendment has two main thrusts, really. It has a series of protections for criminal defendants. It says no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless a grand jury has indicted them. So that's just basically a process question. Like a grand jury of your peers must be the ones who decide that you are going to be charged with a crime under the Constitution.
You know, let's talk about that just a minute see if I have this right. A grand jury consists of a prosecutor, but not a defender. In other words, there's no lawyer defending the person in a grand jury, only the prosecutor. And that's where they say you can prosecute a ham sandwich. I mean, is this true that it just comes from a perspective of the prosecutor and that's it, and he can say anything he wants to? And then
that's right. Grand juries are very different from an ordinary jury and from an ordinary courtroom. Many of the constitutional restrictions that apply in a court of law don't apply in the grand jury context. So, for instance, the grand jury context, grand jury is not an adversarial proceeding where both sides are represented by counsel. A grand jury is solely a prosecutorial device for prosecutors to decide on whether they're going to bring charges against someone. They do collect evidence. They are made up of a jury of your peers, of ordinary citizens, but they deliberate in secret. Prosecution's allowed to, we mentioned earlier, the exclusionary rule that keeps some kinds of evidence out of court if it was illegally obtained. The exclusionary rule does not apply in grand jury hearings. And an individual who is called before the grand jury does not have the right to have an attorney in the room with him when the person testifies. So it's a very different setting, and it is designed, Chuck, as you say, to really favor the prosecutors. It's not a trial on the merits. This is a question about whether there's sufficient evidence to justify a prosecution. As you say, the prosecutor has so much authority in the grand jury room that if he wanted to, he could get the grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
So if I understood you correctly, did you just say that even evidence that may be considered fruit of the poisonous tree in a trial is admissible in the grand jury setting?
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
The exclusionary rule does not apply in that setting. And again, you're not punished for it. You know, you can be the basis of a trial, but unless the government can convict you beyond a reasonable doubt without that evidence, then it doesn't make a lot of sense for prosecutors to pursue it.
So it means the bar that you have to reach in order to indict someone is significantly lower than the bar to convict them.
And really, as it should be, and as it kind of must be. I mean, if we had the same standard at the state of process where the prosecutor is merely deciding whether to bring a case, then presumably you basically be having a trial on the merits before you had a trial on the merits, and that doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, if you're sued by someone civilly, they don't have to go prove their case before they file suit against you. The trial is when they get the chance to prove their case and to get evidence and exchange evidence. And this early stage is really just deciding whether there will be a case that goes forward. And that's a system that very much favors the prosecution.
Well, now, you know, to bring this around to modern day, what's happening as we speak, Mueller is a prosecutor. He had a team of 17 prosecutors. They gave out a paper, 400 pages, that was, you know, said that Trump wasn't guilty of collusion, but it was kind of up in the air. The second part was about obstruction. And so they gave their point of view, but there's actually no pushback on that. This is the prosecution's point of view, but there is no defense for this that we know of at this point, other than he's not guilty, according to them and according to Barr. So this is kind of an interesting situation that the public is only seeing the grand jury kind of thing. They're only seeing the prosecution side of it. Is that correct? Or am I?
Well, that's right. The Mueller report is not designed to be a report for the defense or for the subject
of
the investigation.
He can't exonerate anybody anyway, can he? Because that's a trial.
That's right. And, you know, the president does like to say that the Mueller report exonerated him totally, but that's not what the purpose of the report was, to exonerate or not to exonerate. And the prosecutors generally don't have that authority to, quote unquote, exonerate someone. Generally, they either press charges or they don't press charges. And,
in this case, they
not to press.
Made it look like they
and in this case, they didn't press charges. Right. And so, and the president's right to point that out. But you're absolutely right that when we see the Mueller report, we should recognize it's a prosecutor's report. It's not a balanced, objective view of all the evidence. That's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to
There's
be a
no cross-examination going on here.
That's right. That's right. It wasn't a neutral examination.
Now, the Fifth Amendment, this applies to criminal proceedings, but you can't use the Fifth Amendment in a civil hearing, right?
That's right, because the idea is that you have a protection against self-incrimination. So you cannot incriminate yourself, make yourself guilty of a crime, or reveal evidence that's guilty of a crime contrary to your will, but not a right to fail to testify. Some people think the Fifth Amendment means I have a right to refuse to testify whenever I don't want to testify, but that's not what it provides. Right. So if we remember, go back to the McCarthy hearings in the 1950s, when we had this Red Scare and everyone was talking about how communists were taking over the country. And McCarthy held these hearings and they asked people, like in Hollywood, for instance, to come testify about who else was a communist. And people said, well, I'm going to take the Fifth. I'm going to not don't incriminate myself. But the hearings would often say, well, we'll provide you total immunity, so you can't be prosecuted. And so the question is just whether you're giving us your evidence or not. And people would say, oh, I don't want to give my evidence. But that's not what the Fifth Amendment provides. It says you don't have to provide evidence of your own guilt, of your own crime. It doesn't say anything about a right to refuse to testify about other people's crimes or about things that you did that aren't crimes.
So if Chuck committed a crime and I was called as a witness, I would have no protection if they questioned me about my knowledge of his crime.
None at all. You'd have no protection. You'd be obligated by law to give that evidence, unless you were married to Chuck, in which case you might have a spousal provision. But I don't think you guys are that, you know, sort of fashion forward.
No, we're not that close.
Now, if you would, why is the spousal privilege exist? Where does that come from?
Well, it's an old common law privilege that we provide. There's some common law privileges for certain kinds of communications that doesn't come from constitutional law, but the courts have read the Constitution to embrace some of those common law privileges. The most famous of them, spousal privilege, things that you talk about in private and secret with your wife or spouse cannot be that your spouse cannot be forced to testify against you. We also have the privilege for priest and worshiper, right, that allows confessions that you give to your priest not to be used against you in court. And of course, perhaps the most famous of all, attorney-client privilege, where the things that you tell your attorney are not subject to discovery by the other side. And so these are just longstanding common law privileges that protect people, often in some of the same ways. We think about the Fifth Amendment as creating a privilege, that is a right that you can assert not to testify.
So how did Prosecutor Mueller go after the president's lawyer the way he did and confiscated his documents and his computers and push him to testify on information that should have been attorney-client privileged information?
Well, it is not attorney-client privilege for an attorney and a client to conspire to commit a crime. So there's an exception to attorney-client privilege. It says it does not apply if the attorney and the client are conspiring to commit a fraud together. And where that kind of criminal activity is happening and that they're conducting it together or use of the attorney's services to further that crime, then the privilege does not apply. And in the context of Mr. Cohen, he did end up pleading guilty to several pleading guilty to campaign finance violations. And it seems that for the prosecutors for Mueller's group to actually investigate Michael Cohen and for the Southern District of New York to investigate Michael Cohen and get those access to those documents, that's the Fourth Amendment at work. They would have had to have had probable cause, go before a judge, provide their evidence to support the claim that there was evidence of a crime.
So if I really committed a crime and I hire an attorney and I tell my attorney that I really committed the crime, but I have the right to the best counsel I can get, I have the right to put up a defense. If the attorney is trying to get me off as being not guilty, is he then conspiring?
No. So that's a good question, but no. What the courts have said is that every criminal defendant has a right to challenge every aspect of the government's case. The government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt every element of the offense. And while you're not allowed to lie in court and you're not allowed to perjure testimony or suborn perjury, you can challenge every claim the government makes in a criminal prosecution, and challenge it for credibility, even if you know it's true. But you can obviously you can't lie or suborn perjury in doing that, but you can challenge what the government has done.
Now, Amendment 5 also covers private property too, right?
This is a very important element.
It seems kind of weird to me that they lump that into the same article as self-incrimination. It just seems like such a diverse thing. Why is it in there?
It's really kind of confusing. It doesn't quite fit in into this amendment because it's not just about criminal process. But it is in there. It does say that private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation. And that is basically the power of eminent domain, that states and the federal government have the power of eminent domain, the power to take private property. But there are conditions. They have to provide just compensation, that is fair market value for the property that they've taken. And it should only be taken for public use, not for private use. And that's been a pretty controversial element of the takings clause in recent years. You may be familiar with a high-profile case known as the Kelo case, where in Connecticut they seized the home of some people so that they could turn it over to I think it was a Pfizer plant or one of these big pharmaceutical companies that wanted to build a big office park there. And there was a real question about whether that's really for public use. It wasn't to create a park or a highway or something like that. It was for another private development. And the Supreme Court said that that was allowed so long as the private development had substantial public benefits. But that has really been a controversial ruling, and many states have followed the Kelo case by amending their own laws to prohibit eminent domain when it's when private property is transferred to another private entity.
So we're going to see this played out very shortly when they start talking about building the wall on the southern border from, you know, people who own the land and stuff like that. We're going to be into this amendment hot and heavy, I would think, aren't we?
That's right. The president, to build the wall, there's some question about whether the president needs to seize some private land. And there's two questions. One, does the president have the power to seize the private land in the absence of legislation passed by Congress that allows that to happen? And that's kind of questionable. But then there's the Fifth Amendment question, assuming that Congress allows him to take the land. Do we count that as land that's being taken for public use? Of course, the government would have to provide fair market compensation, so they'd have to provide people their funds, but those people will lose their homes and their ranches and be forced to move.
Well, we'll move on to Amendment 6, which is really leads off with the right to a speedy trial.
That's right. The Sixth Amendment provides that in a criminal prosecution, the accused shall have the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, shall have the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him, shall have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Again, another series of provisions that protect criminal defendants as they're being prosecuted for their crimes. And it's the speedy trial is one that just basically says that you can't be charged with a crime and then held forever. The government needs to go prove its case, and it needs to bring you to trial and give you the opportunity to defend yourself and to win an acquittal and win your freedom. The court has said that any delay of more than a year, unless that year is required, more than the year is required by exigent circumstances or by the defendant's own request, that any delay of more than a year for a trial is too much.
So there is the consequences of that if it's more than a year.
Well, then the prosecution will be dismissed, and the person will be effectively exonerated from their crime. They won't be subject to future prosecution.
Okay.
So there was a case, one of the cases that, going back to Mueller for a minute, Mueller issued a number of indictments, and it was some 26 Russians that they indicted. And one of the indictments that they issued was against a catering company. And what they weren't prepared for was the catering company actually hired, they didn't think anyone would respond. The catering company actually hired a very powerful law firm and went in and fought this charge. And Mueller's attorneys came into the court and told the judge they needed more time because they weren't prepared to move forward. So these people went in and said, look, you've charged this company with a crime of Russian collusion. The company actually didn't even exist during the time period. They were, if my understanding is, they were demanding immediate action. Mueller's people said, we're not prepared to give immediate action. And my understanding was the case was dismissed because the government doesn't have the option of delaying a case once they bring charges?
Well, I'm not familiar with this particular fact pattern and this particular setting. I've heard rumors about this situation without knowing much. But in general, that's right. I mean, we allow the criminal defendant to delay often, right, to prepare an adequate defense. But the government's supposed to be prepared with its evidence when it goes into court and requests subpoena. And in this case, presumably they had evidence to provide support for probable cause to get the original search warrants against that company. The government should be able and be prepared to bring its evidence to trial. It's not necessarily that the defendant can force the prosecutors to do it whenever the defendant really wants. But when there is a hearing called and the prosecutors are expected to have their evidence, don't look for the judge to bail you out.
The judge in this particular case, to paraphrase him, said that had the government not been prepared to have a trial, then they were not prepared to issue an indictment, that they rushed the indictment and should have been ready.
That's right. Well, look, if to get the indictment, you have to go before a grand jury. You have to provide your evidence. So by the time you get an indictment, you should have a whole wealth of evidence about the underlying offense. Otherwise, why do you have an indictment? So it's not surprising, I guess, that the courts would subsequently say, hey, where is your evidence to support this claim?
Now, Article 6 also says that the accused has the right to be confronted by witnesses against him, right?
Yes.
Now, there are things happening on some of the college campuses, which I realize are not courts of law, but there are now some college campuses where if a male is charged with any type of sexual charge from a female, that the school can now issue a ruling and kick the person out of school or do whatever they want to do without the female having to be present or ever being allowed to confront the accuser. How does that happen?
Well, that's happening largely because these are not constitutional cases. If they were constitutional cases, if we were talking about people being charged with crimes by the government, then they would have a right to confront their witnesses. And the whole point of the Confrontation Clause is to avoid the kind of circumstance that you provide, where someone is convicted of a trial but doesn't get to face their accuser and cross-examine that people or cross-examine the witnesses that support the accuser. Now, when schools do this, when colleges and universities do this, we should remember one thing about the Constitution. It only, with one exception, it only applies to government action, to actions by the state, local, or federal governments. It does not apply to private actors. It does not apply to private universities. It does not apply to private liberal arts colleges or private high schools or churches or other things like that. And so if those other kinds of institutions take action against you, even if it's action that hurts you, it wouldn't be covered by the Constitution, so you wouldn't get the benefit of the Confrontation Clause, which, as I said, is designed to prevent this very type of thing from occurring, at least for someone who's charged with a crime.
But a public university would have to live by this?
Yes, a public university. Well, again, the confrontation clause applies in the context of criminal prosecutions and criminal defendants. So I'm not sure even in a public university expelling someone would necessarily require confrontation of witnesses. Again, not a criminal charge, not a criminal offense. But the Constitution does speak to the values that are disserved by allowing someone to be convicted of a crime without being able to confront and cross-examine their chief accuser.
Now, Amendment 6 is also the amendment that requires public defenders, requires the courts to provide attorneys when we can't afford them. Is that correct?
That's right. And this is a rule that's a relatively modern rule. Of course, for most of American history, criminal defendants had the right to be assisted by counsel under the Sixth Amendment, but did not have necessarily any right to government-funded counsel. So you could have your own lawyer, but if you couldn't afford a lawyer, you were sometimes charged and convicted of a crime without any assistance of counsel. The Supreme Court over the course of the 20th century said first in capital cases, cases involving the death sentence, and then later in all felony cases involving indigent defendants, that the right to counsel means the government has an obligation to provide you with counsel if you cannot afford one.
So that's interesting, because now we hear people like Senator Sanders saying that you have the right to have health care, and trying to extend that right to have health care, and you have that the government has an obligation to pay for it.
You know, we often think about rights as being negative rights. That is, rights to prevent the government from doing something to you. So government can't infringe your freedom of speech or can't treat you unequally without any good justification. But what the right to counsel is, and the right to health care would be too, is a more positive right, a right to have the government do something for you. And in the right to counsel, the Supreme Court has said now for almost a century that the right to counsel, for it to be a realistic right, must be one in which indigent defendants are provided counsel by the government. But that is that same kind of positive right that the government has to provide something to you.
Do you see any pathway in the Constitution that would allow for health care to be considered to be, as Bernie Sanders says, a human right that the government has an obligation to provide?
You know, it's not obvious where that would fit within our constitutional framework or which constitutional text would be used. I should say that anyone who's spent their career like me studying the Constitution should say nothing would surprise you in terms of what the Supreme Court will read the Constitution to mean or do. So there's always something that the Supreme Court could hang its hat on. It is hard to imagine how the right to health care would fit within the current text of the Constitution.
All right, so move on to number 7, which is really talking about more common law in civil cases, I believe, right?
That's right. The 7th Amendment deals with suits at common law and says that you shall have a right to trial by jury when you do a civil case, essentially, and that jury shall be the ones who determine the facts of the case in a civil trial. This arose in part because when the Constitution was proposed, it gave the Supreme Court jurisdiction over law and cases involving both law and facts. And some opponents, the anti-federalists, thought that gave the Supreme Court the right to overturn factual findings of juries in civil cases. And they thought that wasn't the appropriate role for the Supreme Court, which should be about reviewing questions of law, not questions of fact. They're not a fact-finding kind of institution, the Supreme Court. They don't take testimony or hear witnesses. This was in part designed to secure the right of people to have their civil trials determined by a jury rather than by the Supreme Court.
So when we look at these criminal trials and the civil trials, there's a different, if you would explain for our listeners, there's a different benchmark that has to be reached in a criminal trial versus a civil trial, right?
That's right. For a criminal conviction, you must be proved, the prosecutors must prove that you're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. If you want to think about this in numeric terms, that's kind of like, 95-98% certainty that someone committed a crime. Whereas for a civil case, all you have to show is that someone was responsible for some wrongdoing and that it was more likely than not, essentially, basically a preponderance of the evidence. So if you want to think of that in numerical terms, it's only, well, there's about 50-55% of the evidence suggests that that person's guilty. That's good enough for a civil case.
So if we were to use the scales of justice, in a criminal case, those scales would need to be obviously tilted. But in a civil case, they would just have to be slightly tilted one way or the other?
That's right. If you want to think about the scales of justice, the scales of justice in a criminal case are heavily weighted on one side, which is to say that the criminal defendant gets all the benefits and the prosecution has a very heavy burden to prove their case. In a civil case, the balance is really equal, that the scales are not weighted one side or another when you start a case, and the person who wins will be the one who has the most evidence on their side. If you just have a little bit more evidence than the other guy, then you can win a civil case. But in a criminal case, the prosecutors must have just much more substantial and stronger evidence. I mean, after all, you are throwing someone in a cage for some number of years. That's a pretty significant harm. In a civil case, you're just taking away some of their money. That's important, not insignificant, especially not for many people, but not quite as the same seriousness as being put in a cage.
Speaking of fairness and scales of justice, let me ask you this question. I'm going to use the Mueller investigation to emphasize why I think it seems to be unfair. So he calls someone in to argue whether they're guilty or innocent. They have to get an attorney. And it goes on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And pretty soon this person who is trying to defend himself runs out of money, and they know he's out of money. And then they start saying, okay, we want you to say this, this, and this. And so he begins to plead to things that didn't even happen, whether he gets exonerated or not or whatever, or some kind of plea deal. But he's just out of money. He's broke at this point. How does that happen, that we have no way to curtail prosecutors to where they just can't run people out of their finances and their home and everything they've accrued over the years, and then protect themselves financially? It just seems so unfair, because they can take as much time as they want and use all of the resources of government against an individual.
Well, that's right. And this is a problem that's long preceded, of course, the Mueller investigation, but the Mueller has shown a new spotlight on the problem. And especially for people who are poor in America, when they're facing the possibility of criminal charges or criminal prosecution or criminal investigation, this is a real heavy burden on so many Americans. And they really have, they're sort of powerless to fight the powers of the prosecutors. The prosecutors sort of have them over a barrel, if you will. And
you know, I had a friend of mine, I'm going to give you an example, because you live in Los Angeles. I have a friend of mine in Los Angeles that was brought before a federal judge in Los Angeles, and he beat it. And they said, okay, that's the state of California. Now we're going to take you to Oregon. And he beat it in about five or six different states, and it cost him a fortune. And his attorney overheard one of the prosecutors come out and say, well, we only have about 30 states to go. I mean, give me a break. In other words, he could take it state to state to state to where he has nothing left. It seems so unfair.
And I'm assuming, Chuck, this was a civil case?
It was not a civil case. In fact, a friend of mine who started, LegalZoom, he represented this guy, and he went in and fixed it with the government.
But Shapiro.
It took Bob about 2 days to fly into Washington, fix it, and everything else. If not, it would have just kept going, and my friend would have lost everything.
Now, how does the Fifth Amendment, the right to not have double jeopardy, not kick in on something like that?
I was just going to say that this really raises an issue, not of the Seventh Amendment so much, but of the Fifth Amendment, which one thing we didn't talk about so much earlier was that the Fifth Amendment provides protection against what they call double jeopardy. You shall not be put in jeopardy for the same offense twice. But as Chuck's example notes, it seems in America you can be prosecuted twice. And again, the Supreme Court has said that. Maybe 50 times. What the Supreme Court has said is that no one government, so no state or federal government, can bring charges against you twice itself. So the state of California can bring charges once against someone, but can't, and if they lose and the person's acquitted, they can't bring charges again against that person. But the federal government could come in, and if there's a federal crime involved in the same set of events, then the federal government can charge and can prosecute. And if another state has, and another state can do it.
It was about buying stocks.
Yeah, which has effect on all 50 states. And you could see how this rule would allow someone to be prosecuted over and over and over again for the same set of events. It's one of the issues that's really bedeviled the Supreme Court in recent years. And just recently, the Supreme Court had a case that presented the question about whether they should revamp its jurisprudence on the Double Jeopardy Clause. But it seemed from oral argument that the justices were reluctant to take that step. But it does mean that someone can be prosecuted over and over and over again, seemingly in violation of the principle articulated by the Fifth Amendment.
Well, I mean, it puts the government in such an interesting situation where it certainly puts the individual in jeopardy, because once you run out of money and run out of any future for yourself at all, and then they look at you and say, well, we want you to, you know, to cop to this plea, or we'll go after the next set in line, who next family member or whatever, and we'll do the same thing to them. I mean, it's like you have nowhere to go.
And they have unlimited resources.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. And it sort of highlights some of the prosecutorial abuse that's really going on in America at all levels of government. And, you know, no one goes to trial anymore. Part of the problem with these criminal procedure amendments is that people don't even go to trial anymore.
Right.
That everyone is threatened with very, very onerous sentences. And so people take a plea agreement to save their money, to save their a few years in jail. But they're ended up pleading guilty is to too many things too quickly. And prosecutors have way too much power in this process.
Thank you.
So this could come up in the Jesse Smollett case then, where Kim Fox dropped the case in Chicago, but the federal government may still step in and prosecute.
That's right, and the federal government would be able to, and that wouldn't raise any particular issues of double jeopardy because the original jurisdiction decided not to prosecute, so he has not been put in jeopardy from the first situation. But even if he were charged by Illinois or charged by the city of Chicago for some crime or offense, because of the way the courts read the double jeopardy clause to say, oh, it's only about one governmental entity bringing successive prosecutions, not about different governmental entities, would allow the federal government to step in, even if Illinois had brought charges and Smollett had been acquitted.
So our last amendment for today is the Eighth Amendment. And this is one that didn't used to get a lot of press, but it's really become an issue recently. And this is the one of excessive bail. Kamala Harris is really making this one of the big points of her campaign for president, that bail, things like bail and bonds and stuff, are excessively high, and that they are increasingly, you know, tilted toward hurting minorities.
That's right. This is, I think, Kamala Harris in that vein is sort of picking up on a trend that's captured both the interest of liberal criminal reformers and libertarian criminal justice reformers, which is an idea that many, many poor people, it's like what Chuck was talking about earlier, people without resources who are poor, if they're arrested for a crime, and then bail is set, but they have no possibility of making bail. There's no possibility they can raise the kind of money necessary to make bail, even if the crime is not that serious. Or with regards to excessive fines, which are also covered by the Eighth Amendment, sometimes someone is guilty of a misdemeanor, and so you're fined a few hundred dollars, but you can't pay the few hundred dollars, and so then interest accrues. And the next thing you know, you owe several thousand dollars. And the next thing you know, you're in jail because you haven't paid the several thousand dollars. Someone who was guilty of a misdemeanor finds themselves in jail because of the fines that are getting out of hand. It's kind of like the old debtor's prison, which we used to have. We used to have something where we'd put people in prison if they owed debts to people. Right. We've eliminated that, saying, hey, look, you want to go to jail, you got to be convicted of a crime.
Well, apparently we haven't really eliminated it, have we?
Well, only if you owe the government the money.
That's right. So I think that Kamala Harris, at least in that vein, is really picking up on a trend that that could be one of those issues where we see some cross-party alignments and some coalition building to actually support some reform.
So who determines that bail is excessive other than the judge who set the bail?
Well, of course, it can be appealed to a higher court, an appellate court, and courts say that you can only set a bail amount that is reasonably calculated to get the person to appear in court later on, right, to guarantee that they're going to come back. And so the excessive bails is part of that, that maybe we need to have bails that are a lower amount because people will still come back and participate. But also a lot of the concern is about the fines, the excessive fines that are imposed upon people for small offenses or misdemeanor offenses. That then sort of grow and become the basis of more serious criminalization and punishment.
How about some of the fines that the federal government itself meters out? You know, FDA, FTC, EPA. I mean, EPA comes up with all kinds of crazy fine amounts that there's no rhyme or reason to the amounts.
Well, the Supreme Court has said that under the excessive fine clause, that any fine that is so grossly excessive as to amount to effectively a deprivation of property without due process is too much. And that leaves a lot to be desired in terms of knowing exactly what's covered. But the idea of so grossly excessive does give government a lot of leeway in imposing fines. Because they can, you know, that is a standard that's hard to meet, that it's not just excessive, not just unreasonably excessive, but grossly excessive. It's hard to know exactly where that line's going to be drawn.
You know, Adam, after listening to you over the few weeks and months that we've been talking about this, it seems to me like the Founding Fathers set up a constitution which protected the individual, from the government. And it's over the 200 plus years, the government has clawed its way back and is clawing its way back to take away those restrictions on itself and put itself back into power over the individual instead of the individual over government. To be protected from the government, the government's now taking all that back. Am I wrong in that, or does it seem like we just keep moving on that scale all the time? The government's clawing it back, clawing it back.
Well, you know, I'd say it's a nuanced question. I think you're absolutely right. There are ways in which it seems that the government has clawed back some of the power that the Constitution seems to vest in the individual. I think you're right about that.
But it
is a complicated story, too, because there's also ways in which the Constitution applies to protect liberty much greater than it ever did at the founding era. So, for instance, the Bill of Rights that we've been talking about, they were originally designed only as a limit on the federal government and didn't limit at all what state or local governments did. Over the 20th century, the Supreme Court expanded and read the Constitution to apply the Bill of Rights to the states and local governments, too. So now the state and local governments can't violate your First Amendment or your Fifth Amendment rights or your right to counsel. And so in some ways, the government has clawed back some power. But overall, we might say that the scope of these constitutional rights applies much broader than it did in the founding era.
So the last part of the Eighth Amendment is the clause about cruel and unusual punishment. Cruel, I think we can all figure out. But unusual seems to be kind of subjective. Who makes that?
Screws in the rack, cruel?
Yeah, I think cruel. I think that one's pretty easy to figure out. But unusual, I mean, I'm looking at Manafort. Manafort was stuck in the solitary confinement for how long, Chuck?
I don't know, but he was there for a while. Yeah.
And it's he wasn't dangerous. He wasn't dangerous. He wasn't a threat to society. But they stuck this guy in solitary confinement for months.
People that they've done that with as well.
Is that not, if that's not cruel, is that at least unusual?
Well, you know, it may be one of the unfortunate facts of a punishment in America is that solitary confinement is not unusual. The court looks at whether something's unusual by looking at whether something is a kind of punishment that has been rejected by society or accepted by society. If something's been accepted, then generally the court's going to say it's not unusual that it does happen. And indeed, while Manafort has warranted the sympathy of many people, there have been Justice Kennedy, before he retired, wrote an opinion saying it was time to really rethink solitary confinement, that we might put people in solitary confinement way too often, way too easily, and that solitary confinement may have a real serious and deleterious effect on people's emotional health and physical health. And so solitary confinement for Manafort was not unusual because it's such a common punishment and practice.
It's like a white-collar
but
crime.
Maybe we need to rethink it.
I'm not a fan of Manafort, don't get me wrong, but it's still a kind of a white-collar crime. It really wasn't, it just seemed like it didn't fit.
I personally am a big enemy of solitary confinement. Solitary confinement can have extremely deleterious effects on people from both a short-term and a long-term a reason. I mean, to me, there needs to be some very compelling reason to do something like that.
That's right. But it's a difficult thing for a constitutional judge in some ways, because solitary confinement has been a practice that's been used in America for a long, long time. There's a long history and tradition of it. How do you read the Constitution to prohibit a practice that the Constitution has long been read to allow? That's one of the fundamental problems with the Eighth Amendment, is that what is cruel and unusual punishment today to our current standards may be a little bit different than what they were at the founding era, when they would burn people alive, draw and quarter people, and hang people in the public square or subject them to pillaring. You know, we don't do those things. And how do we think about those practices 200 years later is a real tough question for constitutional interpretation.
Well, Professor, as always, you do such a fantastic job.
What a pleasure it is to listen to you and learn from you. Appreciate it so much.
And Chuck, on the next episode, we're going to start getting into, I think, the most interesting amendments. We still have the 9th and the 10th, you know, that whole Bill of Rights. But Right. Now we're going to start getting into the amendments that America decided they wanted, where we changed the Constitution. I think that's really going to be some dicey areas when we get into that stuff.
Okay.
It'll be interesting to see whether we did a good job of amending the Constitution.
Let me ask you a question in parting, since we're shutting down right now. I'd just like to get your, and maybe you don't want to give me your opinion, but I'm curious. At this point in time, do you think we're in a constitutional era, or a post-constitutional era, this day and time right now?
And what do you mean by a constitutional era?
Well, are we really following the Constitution and living up to all of the requirements of those laws? Or are we finding ways around them to where we're just kind of not really as constitutional as we should be?
Well, I'm going to say that we're probably not nearly as constitutional as we should be. But I think that's in part because we might disagree with how the court has interpreted the Constitution. I think the court is very much committed to using the Constitution to govern American life and does, it's a difficult job to make these hard calls and in hard cases. And the court thinks that it's doing a good job of keeping the Constitution up to date. But I think for many people, especially with the advent of private power and private companies that exert as much influence over you as any government did back in the 1700s, then all of a sudden we start to feel that maybe these rights aren't doing enough for us.
Yeah, I've got Google, for instance, just as an example.
Professor Adam Winkler, we will have folks, there'll be links to the professor's social media and to his books, his latest book being We the Corporation. And by all means, check that book out and some of his other books.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you very much. And I hope you all enjoyed this today, and we'll see you next time on Blunt Force Truth.